And then you grow up and then you go to Bitcoin.
I'm becoming a toxic Bitcoin maxi. And you see the suffering, the income inequality, disappearance of the middle class, you know, the lack of housing affordability. And you start seeing all these things and seeing how Bitcoin can fix that. I feel like it's my role as a human being on planet Earth to help other people see that.
That's so true. And I've had goosebumps probably like four different times.
And the way the core team managed the process, it was like, we're doing it, and they didn't engage the community. They were just going to impose this change on the world, and you're an idiot if you don't understand why it makes sense to do it. I'll be going back to Steak and Shake, which is one of my favorite restaurants as a kid, for the first time in 30 years, as I've just started introducing meat back in my diet, and I get to spend Bitcoin, which is my passion.
I have Dr. Boyd Cohen here today, and you are an author and you've written The Bitcoin Singularity, and I actually just ordered it today, so I'm super excited to read it.
Awesome.
It's right up my alley. I love hearing about how Bitcoin will reshape the future. I love the idea of the Bitcoin cities, just imagining that future. So I think that your book will be super interesting.
Thanks. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I've like all of us, I've been going deep down the rabbit hole for quite a while. And, you know, I listen to podcasts every day quite a bit. And this framing about Bitcoin as sort of beyond the financial and macro and into like how it could tangibly affect our world, our communities, our cities, our lifestyles, not just now, but in the future. That was something I felt was missing, not just in the podcast and the dialogue, but also in the books that are out there. And there's so many great books. Lynn Alden's Great Start with Broken Money, and Larry Leppard's book on The Big Print, and of course, Saif al-Din and Bitcoin Standard, and several other just like can't miss books are out there already, but not many of them are trying to look at like, what's going to be the evolution of society if we really embrace Bitcoin, and over what period of time is realistic, and what are all the implications of living on a Bitcoin standard at scale? And that's sort of the take I brought to the book.
I love that. And I love that when you reached out to me, it was really nice to hear from you that you enjoyed the podcast and you were thinking of doing something similar. You enjoyed that different take on, you know, listening to people based on not just their stories, but what they think about just how Bitcoin can affect all parts of our lives, like all different ideas that we have about life because of Bitcoin. And that is definitely a part that I haven't touched too much on. You're going to be way more in depth, giving us a clearer picture of what that might look like. We know that it's going to transform our future, but just we don't hear enough about how that's going to look. You've been a keynote speaker, different conferences, like global, like what is it, like economic conferences and tech conferences?
Yeah, so I've had I got my PhD at the University of Colorado in 2001. And I know in the Bitcoin community, sometimes it's like you're supposed to not talk so much about formal education because there's a lot of people who just have a natural dislike for that. And I actually understand why. So I don't always say that. In fact, I was advised to remove PhD after my name for the book and everything. So I did that. But you know, I'm not hiding from it entirely. So I've had this kind of unusual career. This is my fifth book. I've published a lot of academic peer-reviewed journal papers, and I've also started six companies along the way.
I saw that.
So I've had this kind of weird journey of back and forth between being like 1 or almost 2 feet in academics and then 1 or 2 feet only in entrepreneurship. And it's been on that journey that I've, you know, developed some name recognition in some of the fields that I've really been diving deep in. I mean, if you look at my whole career, it's been around the intersection of technology, innovation, and sustainability. A lot of my work was done with that perspective in the context of cities and smart cities. So a lot of my keynotes were in the smart city space. I used to contribute to Fast Company on smart cities, and that sort of gave me some profile. I did a TEDx talk on that topic many years ago. And I still do keynotes even recently. But of course, more of my keynotes now are combining those topics in Bitcoin, which is, you know, increasingly something probably you feel the same way. I got to the point at the end of 2024 after just having such a high level of conviction that I committed myself to being pretty much full time in Bitcoin by the end of this year, whether that's through university engagement, but building Bitcoin related programming for executives and for business students, which is the area I tend to work in, or leaving the university sector behind again and working in the private sector. So that's still like an evolution right now. I've been bringing Bitcoin education back into the business school, which is really fun. There are almost no business school professors I can find in the world that are doing this yet.
That's amazing.
I know, isn't it weird that
yeah,
it's not happening yet? I mean, it's happening all around us in terms of adoption, corporates, Bitcoin native startups. Like, Bitcoin is going to change our world in such dramatic ways, and yet my colleagues around the world are just not even paying attention yet, which is really annoying. And part of the reason so many Bitcoiners are anti-formal university yet.
Yeah, it's true. It's annoying because you think that the people that should know about this stuff, the people that manage the most amount of funds in the world, don't understand money in the first place, and they don't understand this revolutionary technology. It is frustrating, and I think what you're doing is incredible because you're actually putting it to work. You're teaching people about it. You're actually educating younger people about it. So I love seeing that this cycle, you're seeing people like yourself turn to the education portion where you're educating the youth. You need to spread the word that way and show them, because it is being taught in other countries. It's being taught like in schools in other countries.
Yeah, I think, El Salvador is obviously a real outlier on that. There's a few other countries where you're seeing more of that, even entering like primary and secondary, but it's still very, we're still very early in sort of Bitcoin becoming part of an educational curricula at any stage. And that's why there's also so many other entrepreneurs and innovators looking at ways to get the word out in different ways rather than through the formal education. And I think basically what we need is everything. We need people doing children's books. We need people doing content in podcast form and YouTube short videos and TikTok or whatever. We need formal education in primary and secondary and university. We need to basically re-educate people too. So I'm doing a lot in the business school for MBA students, but I'm now also doing executive ed courses on Bitcoin. And so these are people that are already 10, 15, 20 years into their career. And as you say, they're often maybe the hardest to sort of transform. I think a lot of us adults who get geeked out on Bitcoin, for example, we get so deep into the weeds that sometimes it's hard for us to take a step back and say, okay, first principles, explaining. I was at a dinner the other night. My daughter's best friend, she's been best friends with her for almost a year. We'd never had dinner with her parents, and we just did this past weekend. And her dad is a CFO at a major public company. It's a Mexican subsidiary of a Latin American public company. And he had heard of Bitcoin. He was more interested in stable coins than Bitcoin for interesting reasons. But he wasn't at all down the rabbit hole at all. And by the time I was done with him, the next day he told me he's going to buy some MSTR. So I'm like, okay, I made progress. I didn't get all the way to, convincing him to go to, self-custody Bitcoin. But my point is, like, we could all learn to be able to speak in a way that meets the person where they are rather than where we are. And sometimes that involves starting from a much lower level.
Yeah, because I think even your PhD, I think for people that are traditionally educated, I know that some Bitcoiners might not like, the traditional education, but I think for the majority of people that don't understand Bitcoin, when they see that you're a PhD, it would actually be like, oh, okay, I should listen to this guy because he, they wouldn't want to listen to somebody who they think isn't traditionally educated.
The way to like simplify that from my perspective, from engaging with people, is like on Twitter, it's better to not have a PhD by your name. And on LinkedIn, it's great to have one. So it's like totally different audiences. LinkedIn is like mainstream professionals who do still think of credentials in the old school way. And yes, it's helpful in that regard. Whereas on Bitcoin Twitter, it's probably detrimental to getting an audience.
It's true. But I think that's why when I introduced you, I said doctor, because that's an accomplishment and you understand Bitcoin and that's great. You know, so for me to say that I'm on Twitter, I don't know if many people would, I don't have to put it in the title, you know, so that people don't see doctor and be like, what the heck? But I think that it's important to say that because that's amazing because so many people that are educated that far along, they don't want to go and look at something new too much. So it's nice to see that somebody from that level of education still has an open mind, you know, and can educate others from that
standpoint. I think that's a pretty critical point, to be honest. And one that's sort of bothering me a lot lately is the lack of interest from my colleagues. I mean, I'm orange pilling them personally, like the ones that are around me in the business school, you know, without, you know, offending anyone or naming names. It's just an example of how far we have to go. I have a colleague who's been in academics for like 30 years. And this would have happened maybe 3-4 months ago. And I was trying to orange pill him. I was talking to him about, you know, all the reasons why I'm passionate about Bitcoin and also why it relates to topics that we care about in the business school. So I was explaining to him, you know, Bitcoin versus fiat. And you won't believe the very first question I got. This is a guy who's been in academics for 30 years. As a PhD, has been teaching MBAs and doctoral students, not in finance and economics, more in strategy and ethics and other topics. His first question was, "What is fiat?" Not exaggerating. Very first question. I'm like, "Oh, here's why I like Bitcoin and why it's superior to fiat." He's like, "Boy, hold on a second. What is fiat?"
Yeah. I think that's important, though, because I think a lot of people, when they first hear that word, if they're not into Bitcoin, they don't know that fiat is a separate, like, they don't know that it's a man-made currency. They don't, like, it's not a word that people use, you know? So I think maybe sharing that more, for, you know, in the real world, so people understand that word, because so many people, they hear that and they're like, "Well, I don't know what that means. It's just money is money." So I think the word fiat confuses people. Because even when I first probably found out about Bitcoin, I'm like, "Oh, this like money made by people is called fiat." Like, I think I didn't realize that either. So I think it's something that should be more well known. It should be something that we should use more day to day, you know, and just explain what it is or something. Because, yeah, that word is like a mystery to people. They're like, "Stop right there. I need to figure this out. What is
that?" Well,
I can't go on if I don't know what that word is.
But you know, you would assume business school professors and for decades, kind of that's just understood like knowledge. But even now, I would say I haven't tested this on my colleagues, but I have on my students. In fact, when I teach Bitcoin now, the very first question I usually ask them is what causes inflation?
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, at the root of sound money is that it's like, okay, inflation is what's creating all the pain in our world that we're trying to fix with Bitcoin. So do you understand what inflation is and where it comes from? And until you get that, you're not going to get Bitcoin. At least that's my opinion.
Right.
So I start with that question, and you'd be surprised that basically none of my MBA students have a clue.
Isn't that, that's mind-boggling. Like, you can't believe that being in those type, that level of education, that you don't know that. It's like, why hasn't anyone taught it? It's because they know that, I think, that if it's taught too much, that people would see through, you know, the theft and the lies, you know? So I think once you actually find out about it, so all they learn about mainly is like credit and loans and debt and all that stuff, but they don't learn about inflation and what's happening.
I think it's because I've reflected on this a lot, because, you know, I was on the same journey. And, you know, I really learned about a lot of this in the last few years, even though I also have a PhD in business, everything else. And I actually think it's because it's like this institutional inertia that, you know, universities, business school professors, they learn from their professors in their PhD program. I didn't learn about inflation in my, I have three business degrees. Nobody explained to me exactly what causes inflation. I didn't understand what quantitative easing was until after I never heard the term until like 10 years ago or something like that. It was never brought up in all of my studies because, of course, in business school, you don't study that much economics, even though people think you do. You're learning more about finance and business than like classical economics principles. And I would say that every business school professor, maybe not every, but the majority of us were brought up and raised in a Keynesian economics kind of mindset. And it's not necessarily, I think a lot of Bitcoiners who are into conspiracies think it's like a global conspiracy that the governments have funded universities just to brainwash us to only teach around Keynesian. I don't think that's true. I mean, there may have been some subtle efforts around that in the past, but I think it's just like inertia. We learn from the people that taught us, and the people that taught them are more on the Keynesian side, where they even understood they were Keynesian or not, because they, if they're in business, not economics, they might not have even understood the difference between Austrian and Keynesian. You know, it's not something that average business school professor is immersed in. So I think it's just, it's like this vicious circle of educators educating future educators with old knowledge, or not even old knowledge, because obviously Austrian economics is not new, but with sort of a Keynesian mindset.
Well, I think that that's something that it lacks critical thinking skills, because here you're just like, okay, my professor taught me this, they know best, I'm gonna like follow their lead, and I'm just gonna do what they say because they know better than me and they've done this. They're, you know, they look up to these people and they think I have to learn what they know, you know. But it's like, how about questioning stuff sometimes? How about having critical thinking? And I think a lot of people lack that, and they just like follow the leader.
You know, it's like the expression takes a village, and it does. It takes a we're trying to transform the global economy or global society around Bitcoin and sound money. And, you know, when you're starting from a base where not only, I would argue it's not a base of zero, it's a negative base, because people have all these inherent biases around how the world works, and that some basic amount of inflation is good, and that, yeah, things are supposed to cost a little bit more every year. And so we have to, like, you know, bring people down to a base of understanding why that's not necessarily good, and then get them to Bitcoin and why sound money is superior, and then start helping them understand all the ways they can embrace Bitcoin, not just as a savings technology, but also from the book, all the different ways that Bitcoin can change our lives, our societies, our communities, and how you can get involved in the journey as well, which is, you know, also exciting, because once you get enough conviction, it's frustrating to just sit and hold it, even if it's only going up. It's like, well, I want to be part of this. And so then it gets to, okay, well, how do you educate your kids? How do you communicate to your parents? How do you, what else can you do with the skills you have? Maybe you're good in marketing. Maybe you're good in technology innovation. Maybe you're good in design. Maybe it doesn't matter, but okay, how can you leverage the skills you have to actually move them, take Bitcoin to another level? And I think something a lot of people have problems with, myself included, who also consider themselves not just sort of intellectual, but also like hands-on builders of things. So that's why I've started a bunch of companies. It's like when you come to Bitcoin, your natural inclination when you get enough conviction, but not enough, is you want to do stuff. Okay, well, how can I make Bitcoin better? And then you come to finally realize you can't make it better. What you can do is make the world better by helping more people get on board with it and understand the tools they have for self-custody, or again, get more involved in helping it grow in other ways.
So somebody asked me this question on my podcast, and I thought it was really interesting going along with what you said, because he asked me, since I started my podcast, do I feel more connected? Do I care more about Bitcoin now because I'm doing something for Bitcoin? I'm spreading the word about it. And I think that you do. I think when you become, like, not only are you convicted, but you actually try to spread awareness, use your skills, like you said, to build something or educate more people, or just to live more in the Bitcoin space and just, you know, build that world out that you want to see, it does make you feel like you're more part of it because you're not just sitting on the sidelines. You want to do something, you know, you're excited about this future. You want to see it happen. And even if it's something like a podcast, like with mine, I thought the more that people do it, the more the voice spreads, the more the education spreads. So it's not like we're getting diluted by doing these things or diluting others by doing these things. We're just amplifying the message. So I think that's something that, yeah, use your skills, whatever it is, even if it's just me talking and I love talking about Bitcoin, that's what I'm doing, you know? So I'm not a builder. I don't know how to do the stuff you do, but we all have our talents and we could think of ways to feel connected to this network, you know, and feel connected to building it out and sharing it.
Yeah, I personally feel, and this is, you know, not everyone shares this view because I sometimes get in debates and not debates, but I disagree with some people on Bitcoin Twitter who say get frustrated by trying to orange pill people who don't get it. And they just say, you know what, that's not my job. I'm just going to, you know, stack sats and stay humble and do what I do in my life and not try to orange pill others. And you know, what's really funny about this is that when I first got exposed to Bitcoin in 2016, and it was when I was writing my third book, I think it was, and I wrote a lot about blockchain and I wrote about Bitcoin in that book, but I really didn't get Bitcoin, not anywhere near where I am today. And I ended up getting more interested in the Ethereum ecosystem back then. And one of the reasons, there were two big reasons for that. At that time, there was way more opportunities to build stuff on top of Ethereum than there was on top of Bitcoin in that period. Now you can build on layer twos on Bitcoin. And I started a company to build something in the Ethereum ecosystem. But the second thing was when I engaged with Bitcoiners, either on Twitter or other places, they came across as toxic maxis that were so biased that they couldn't appreciate the contributions or potential of anything else in the crypto blockchain ecosystem. And I found it offensive because I'm a person who believes the world is gray and not black and white. It's like everything I do when I teach students everything, there is no black and white in the world. There is only a bunch of shades of gray. And so this sort of like, you're either a Bitcoiner or you're a shitcoiner thing. And at that time, I don't remember they were using that term as much, but they were saying the same thing in different words, offended me just from my sense of having more objectivity and not right. being so like toxic about something.
Yeah.
Well, what I've discovered in the last year is that toxic Bitcoin mindset in general, maybe I'm not speaking for everyone who is, doesn't come from a place of necessarily subjectivity and blindness to things going on around them, but it comes to a level of conviction you have around Bitcoin when you get deep enough in it. And I wasn't deep enough at that point to appreciate that. And so where I'm going is now where I'm on my journey, I'm becoming a toxic Bitcoin maxi. I guess maybe with a little more empathy than they have around the Ethereum and the crypto community, because I came from that first. So I understand the builder mindset in the crypto space, obviously not the fraudulent meme coin crap, but like there are real serious builders in the Ethereum, EVM, smart contract world that are trying to make the world a better place and just haven't fully appreciated why Bitcoin is just so superior. But I think once you get to that point of that level of conviction, yeah, you can be annoying to people who were like me many yeah. years ago, but then you see that, at least how I see it, your job when you have that level of conviction, you actually see the world that there is a bit more black and white now, that there are things in the world that, you know, sound money is absolutely superior and it is black and white to fiat. There is no gray in that. Fiat is terrible. And as you get to see that and you see the suffering, the income inequality, you know, the disappearance of the middle class, you know, the lack of housing affordability, and you start seeing all these things and seeing how Bitcoin can fix that. I don't know, for me, I feel like it's my role as a human being on planet Earth to help other people see that. And I think a lot of toxic Bitcoin maximalists are in the same boat. It's not because they're trying to pump their bags. It's not because they're biased in one thing. It's because they see where the world is going and they want more people to get on before the Titanic sinks, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. That's so true. And I've had goosebumps probably like four different times. I always say that when I talk to my guests. I feel like I always get chills at some point, but I just had like, you know, back to back chills. But yeah, it's true. It's you're trying to do it because you're, from your point of view, when you first start out and you're into other coins, you're thinking, you know, yes, I want to build this crypto world, right? And even myself, when I got started, I understood inflation, I understood the money printing, and I understood Bitcoin. But Bitcoin seemed expensive at the time. And then there was all these other coins. And you thought, oh, well, all of crypto is crypto, right? You know, so I think we just didn't understand the difference back then that that other crypto, anything besides Bitcoin, has inflationary properties, you know, so, and it also has, you know, people that control majority of the coins, the people that started these companies, and people that can manipulate supplies, and anything that can be manipulated by humans, changing the rules of anything or causing your net worth that you put into this thing to be less, or somebody rug pulling you, all this pain that happened to people during that time, it was something that turned you into a maximalist. So it's like, at first you're like, okay, I love this whole world. This is great. You know, I love crypto. I love the future and everything that's changing. I was a gamer back when I started learning about Bitcoin. I was playing video games all the time. So when I heard about the sandbox game with Ethereum and with the sandbox token and with Snoop Dogg and all these people that were, you know, part of the sandbox world, I was playing sandbox and I was over there doing my missions and collecting everything. And I was like, I loved gaming, you know, so I was doing all that stuff. And I thought, this is, you know, the future of gaming, the future of everything is going to be some sort of virtual currency of any kind. You know, I did think back then the same as you. I thought people that were so into Bitcoin seemed toxic, but because they've been burned, you know, they've been rug pulled, they've been, you know, they've just seen scammers and they've seen all this stuff. And with Bitcoin, it's different. It was almost like Ethereum in that world to me, which I don't know if this is the case. It feels like that world was like the birth of the test, you know, the test ecosystem that was trying to see the things that could be. And then now they kind of might be implemented on top of Bitcoin.
My theory, and I think I might even talk about, I have a chapter in Bitcoin Singularity just on scaling Bitcoin. And I talk about not just Lightning Network, but all the layer twos and all the things being built on or around Bitcoin. And my theory is it absolutely was not intentional, though. What a lot of people forget is that Vitalik Buterin, who founded Ethereum, was a Bitcoin maximalist and was in Bitcoin very early on. And he started seeing the potential to decentralize the world's economy on the internet with smart contracts. And he tried to figure out initially if he could be done in Bitcoin. And at that time, this was like, I think he started around 2012. There was no clear path for doing that. And so he reluctantly started Ethereum as with a lot of the initially same values and principles. And it was a proof of work at that time as well.
Yeah, it was. And yeah.
So Ethereum and the ecosystem around it didn't then, nor does it today, think of itself as a test bed for what can be deployed in the Bitcoin world. But my theory is anything that crosses the chasm in the Ethereum world that demonstrates there's user adoption and interest in this will be built and deployed on Bitcoin and will be better in Bitcoin for all kinds of reasons, because it's built on a better sound money economy, but also because the liquidity as of today is 6 to 7x more in Bitcoin. So it's just easier pathways to grow a protocol or a solution, a dApp, a decentralized app, or a DeFi protocol, or a real world asset thing on top of Bitcoin. So I don't think they see it that way today. Although what's interesting is that a lot of the builders who are building in that world are starting to also deploy their same solution on Bitcoin layer twos. So, for example, Rootstock, which I talk about in the book, because I've engaged with Rootstock quite a bit, they were the first, they're often called a sidechain, but they were the first to go live back in 2017 or 18. They were born in Argentina, but they're pretty global now. And They are an EVM, so Ethereum Virtual Machine compatible layer 2 on Bitcoin. And so when you think about all the protocols and technology that are built in the Ethereum ecosystem, they make it so easy for an Ethereum builder to also to deploy their solution on Bitcoin. And that's starting to happen with some of the biggest protocols in the Ethereum world. So I think it's going to happen even more in over time. But yeah, it's the most logical direction this ends up being. If Bitcoin becomes the base layer of the global economy, and things like DeFi are going to happen somewhere, they're going to happen on Bitcoin, just on a layer two.
It's almost like a sporting event, like the players go to practice and then they join the actual main event, you know, so it seems like they're going to Ethereum to practice and to get ready for it. And then they just move over. And now they're going to the real stadium and they're actually there with, you know, so it's
looking like a true big toxic Bitcoin maxi, because you say that in the Ethereum world, they would be pretty offended. But in the Bitcoin world, that's like, yeah, that's
sorry. I guess I am pretty toxic now, but I just think that it's just literally the playground. I don't know. So it's like, you can, the little kids are playing, they're like, hey, we're going to build all these things. And then you grow up and then you go to Bitcoin. the other thing that I was wondering your opinion on is, I don't know if you have thoughts on this, but before I became so toxic, right? At the time when all this stuff started to go to shit, though.
Yeah.
Ordinals and all that stuff were being built on Bitcoin. So same idea as the NFTs on Ethereum, but now they're on Bitcoin. So when I heard that happened, I thought, wow, that's actually pretty revolutionary for the stuff that was going on Ethereum to now be happening on Bitcoin. So I did buy like 3 just to support Bitcoin. You know, I wanted to support anything being built on Bitcoin. I bought 3 NFTs on Ordinals. And they were just like cheap, like $5, $10 NFTs. You know, I just bought them just to have them, just for like to say I did this. You know, I was part of this movement. You know, that's pretty cool that people are doing stuff on Bitcoin instead. And it was at a time where everything was literally like, nobody had any, like, I think it was like $16,000 Bitcoin at the time. I don't know how low Bitcoin's price had gotten when this happened, but it was pretty much towards the bottom of the last cycles. Then there was these, you know, runes, like these runestones that were given to people. It was called like this free and fair launch that they gave to people who were there, you know, when everybody else left. And then after that, they dropped you these like dog coins that were like, you know, pretty much like a Doge, but like a Bitcoin dog coin. So I have these dog coins just sitting there that I got, you know, because I was supportive and I've just held them. They're just sitting there. So in a way, like, I feel like whatever ends up happening with Ordinals or any of that, but I think it just, I thought it was pretty interesting. I'm still a Bitcoin maxi. I'm not going to go buying a bunch of stuff, but I just thought, why not support things being built on Bitcoin? But then now with this whole core, you know, Bitcoin core and knots and all this like controversy going on between changing the code, and I think it has something to do with Ordinals, so it could stop, you know, the spam on Bitcoin. They want to stop like that type of thing from taking up too much block space or whatever. I don't know if you have any thoughts on what's going on with changing core or anything like that, or do you even know much about that?
Yeah, I do have thoughts about it. You know, kind of similar to you. So when I first heard about runes and ordinals, I was still in the Ethereum world, and I was starting to get more interested in Bitcoin at that time, but I wasn't anywhere near a maxi of any kind. And I remember I was still listening to the Bankless podcast regularly, which is, you know, the Ethereum, the default Ethereum podcast. And they brought on experts in what was happening in the runes and ordinal space. And I embrace their logic. From the Ethereum perspective, it's like you think about building things on top and creating more utility around the protocol. And I was like, yeah, these Bitcoin toxic Bitcoin maximalists that are opposing it doesn't make any sense. They're going to create more transaction volume. It's going to be better for the miners. It's innovating. And so I bought into it full on. And now it's funny because, you know, fast forward, now that I'm a toxic Bitcoin maximalist myself, I was last few days ago, I was in the city of Mexico for, I did a book launch at La Casa de Satoshi, which is it's like a Bitcoin community gathering place in Mexico City, which is really cool. And I did the launch for an hour, which was super fun and very engaged and everything. Of course, I sold books in the on the Aqua Bitcoin wallet, which was fun too. But then after I finished, Gustavo, who's like the leader of the Casa Satoshi community in Mexico City, who's also a Bitcoin builder, he presented an open dialogue and debate around the whole topic of the op return and data in the layer one and everything. And we had a healthy discussion about the whole thing in a very, you know, pleasant, it wasn't hostile or anything. It was just an open discussion. And my take is, you know, now in as I've evolved my thinking around the role of Bitcoin in our economy and society, is that layer one should really just be about the Bitcoin transaction layer for money and nothing else. And that's why we have layer twos and beyond, which is, well, you want to build cool, fun stuff on top of Bitcoin? Have at it. I'm hugely supportive of layer twos on Bitcoin and being permissionless, build whatever you want, deploy whatever you want on layer two. Yes, it'll settle down to layer one, but it's not going to congest layer one, and it doesn't distract from the mission of what the layer one is for. So that's like my general take on it. But it, like we talked about earlier, there aren't many things that are black and white in the world other than the fact that fiat is bad and sound money is good. It isn't black and white, this topic. Like, first of all, it's harder than we think it is to just like eliminate any use of data anywhere in the layer one that's, you know, non-monetary based data. It's almost impossible to eliminate it anyway. So it's probably going to happen. So if it's going to happen, where does it happen, and what barriers do we put up so that it doesn't get out of hand? So that's, you know, one thing that I recognize. And the other thing that came up in the discussion in Mexico City, which is interesting, is that like the core reason the core developers started thinking about expanding the size of the op return was in part because there's a promising layer two that's using zero knowledge proofs that actually needs to access the layer one somewhere with a small amount of non-monetary data for it to work as a layer two zero knowledge proof. And so then you say, well, you know, that was kind of what happened with Lightning too, that there was a logical rationale to enable some amount of Lightning base layer functionality to be incorporated into the layer one so that it could work as a payments channel for Bitcoin. And so then you say, well, then those are clearly rational uses of layer one to enable these uses of layer two that could improve the adoption utility of Bitcoin and be that base layer of a new economy. And then you say, well, okay, if you buy that, then you say, well, we believe in permissionless decentralized protocols, including Bitcoin. Then who are we to judge what is a good use of the Bitcoin layer one and what is a bad use of it? And even though I think like intuitively we can say maybe JPEG should be on layer two, where do you draw the line?
When you think about the whole idea of Bitcoin is code and code is free speech and speech, you know, everything is like all this free speech and not controlling, nobody controls anybody, anyone could do what they want, but it's like you choose to use the network or you don't. I mean, Bitcoin layer one isn't going anywhere, right? So it's just kind of, I think that if this is only to allow things to be like JPEGs or whatever they want to use on a layer two, like a Lightning, then yeah, who are you to, you just don't have to use that or participate in that. If you don't want to, you just participate in layer one and Lightning. You don't have to participate in other things that are built on top of Bitcoin. So Bitcoin, we've always thought of, since I became a maxi, as a bedrock for digital Manhattan. So you think of, if it's the bedrock of this new city, You can't just have the bedrock and then everyone's standing on there. You know what I mean? Besides, yes, we are transacting value. Perfect. But if people want to build this bustling city, there's going to be things built on top of that bedrock, you know? So it's like, I mean, I guess people just can choose to participate in that or not. So the OP, what is that exactly? It means the transactions.
The block size doesn't change. They're talking about expanding the op return size limit, which is like an arbitrary number they used. The way I understood it from this debate we had in the La Casa de Satoshi the other day is that basically there are different sources of processing that is required to execute our blocks, and they come in different forms with different functionality. SegWit's one, op returns another, and there are places where data can be embedded. And there's some size constraints on those. Some of them directly tie to a cost and some do not, depending on where you embed the data. And so there's a lot of these different variables. But as you say, and probably at least in the debate we had the other day, they were saying that it's important to know that block size is not on the table. Another thing, going to your point about like you could choose to opt in or not, yes and no. Like if they expand the capacity of op return and the nodes embrace that expanded capacity, then the whole network and all the transactions in the blocks are exposed potentially to this data, whether you want it to be or not. And whether you're just a user or a holder of Bitcoin or not, you don't necessarily have a choice. Now, that's why the Knots thing is taking off, because Knots was an alternative node software that was, I think, something like 1% of all nodes were operating Knots and the rest were Core. And enough people got upset about what was happening around possibly expanding the op return size capacity that a bunch of node operators are like on strike against Core and have now swapped out their software for their node for Knots, which not going to expand the op return limit so that it would allow for more data to go into it. And one of the things
if it becomes a bigger amount of users using nodes using Knots, then they can't implement this rule because there's more than 50%.
No, they can, but it will only be administered by the code, the Core node operators. So you can have it op return with higher capacity and lower capacity operating on different node networks. So the Knot network, which is apparently, I think I saw the data the other day, is now up to 9% of all of the nodes in the world. So it went from like, I don't remember the exact data, but I think it's like 1% to 9%. So yeah. Enough node operators say, you know what, we don't want to be part of that expansion of op return. So we're going to switch our software to the Knots software for node operation. And this, the Knots one is not adhering to the up of the increased size capacity of the op return.
So what does that mean for the user of Bitcoin?
Not much, nothing really, because from a user perspective, unless you're like a holder of, if you are like fully, you know, into self custody and truly being self sovereign, you can hold your Bitcoin in self-custody, you can have your own miner and you can have your own node in your house, and you can actually engage in all of your transactions without touching a network you don't want to touch in the sense of Core, for example. But if you're, you know, I have a solo Satoshi miner at home. I don't have a node yet, but I'd like to have one. If and when I do, I will operate on the Knots node network. Now, I'm also influenced by Samson Mao because it hasn't come up yet today, but I'm also strategic advisor to Gen3.
Yes, I saw that. Okay, I want to hear about that too, but yes, continue.
So you know, he's our spiritual leader at Gen 3, and he's also a leader for many people in Bitcoin, and he's been very outspoken against it. And one of the things I 100% agree with him on, like 1000%, and I argued this as well in the debate we had in Mexico City, is that part of this has been the way the core team managed the process. It was like, we're doing it, and they didn't engage the community. And some people who are either part of the core team or even advocates for core say, well, this is not something that requires consensus, so they didn't have any need to do it. And my take is, whether there's a requirement for consensus or not, to me, is irrelevant. Like, the Bitcoin community doesn't behave that way. We don't have those values. We don't have the top-down dictatorial, well, the rules allow me to do it, so I'm going to do it, no matter what the rest of the Bitcoin community thinks about it. That just doesn't feel right for Bitcoiners and for the community. And that, I think, is, I don't want to speak for Samson, because he's got well-articulated points and ways of expressing himself. But one of the things I sensed from him was that as well, was this frustration for, like, they were just going to impose this change on the world, and you're an idiot if you don't understand why it makes sense to do it.
Yeah.
And that's not the Bitcoin way that I.
No, exactly. Not me either. I don't like any, like, why, I don't want the changes to happen. I just think that anybody who wants to change it is because they're against whatever is trying to be built on top of it, and they want to stop it. But it's like, just let it be. It's working fine. There's layer twos. There's other, I don't know. I don't think it's a problem. We have Aqua. We have, you know, that Bitcoin layer two through Aqua. We have, you know, Lightning Network. We have all these different things. So I just don't agree with it either. I think it's crazy. So do you work with Bevan Waite also?
No, not yet. Okay. I only started collaborating with Gen 3 maybe 4 or 6 weeks ago.
Okay.
So it's pretty early, and I've interacted with Samson a few times directly, and their chief business officer as well. You know, you can just do things, so we're just doing things. So we're going to host a Stake and Shake experience, encouraging people to use Aqua and, you know, take some footage of it and everything. And, you know, probably a lot of your audience and you yourself are based in the US. And so it's probably not like so special, because a lot of people have Stake and Shake somewhere near where they live, but we don't. So, you know, and what's cool for me is there's a whole lot to unpack in that, but I can do it quickly, which is that I grew up in Illinois in the States, in Peoria.
I'm in Illinois right now.
Oh, really? So I grew up in Peoria, 3 hours south. And we had a Stake and Shake there, and I actually used to love going there. I haven't eaten at a Stake and Shake in over 30 years. And one of the reasons I haven't eaten at a Stake and Shake in over 30 years, first of all, I've lived outside the US since 2001, which is 24 years ago. But also before then, I was having some like health issues at university, and I went to a doctor, and he asked me about my diet, and he ended up concluding I was eating too much red meat and fried foods, and it was causing digestion problems and everything else. He said, take a week off of fried foods and red meat and see how you feel. And all of a sudden I felt lighter. I felt better. I didn't have any problems anymore. And that was, I mean, this ages me, obviously. I think I'm 54, and that happened when I was in university. I think it was in 1991, right around there. So I never ate red meat again ever since then.
But wow.
The funny thing is, the Bitcoin community is all into, you know, as you know, all these health things, you know, creatine and walking and red meat and tallow and all this stuff. And I started reading more about it and saying, you know what, like, maybe I should try reintroducing red meat into my life. And this was literally only 6 weeks ago. And I'm trying, like, it's funny, like, now it's psychological and everything else. Three decades without it, it's like, doesn't even appeal. A lot of it doesn't appeal to me. I've tried a few pieces of steak, and I tried one the other day. I kind of liked it, but I only tried one. Like, I'm not confident enough to like go to a steakhouse and order a big steak, but I have been eating burgers, and those I'm now getting, I'm actually starting to like them again. Okay. In fact, when I was in the strategy conference in Orlando a few weeks ago, I went to this, they call it Beach. It was a bar at the hotel, a bar restaurant right by the pool. And I was down to two options. There was a healthy, sounding good fish sandwich thing with veggies or whatever, and there was a burger, and I'm like, that my intuition was like, I gotta go for the healthy fish thing because that's what I do, and I it sounded good anyway. And I'm like, no, but I need to eat more red meat. I need to try because there's some ingredients in red meat you just don't get in your diet if you don't eat it. So I'm like, no, I forced myself to eat a burger, and I enjoyed it, but it's like it's been a journey. So it's kind of coming full circle that a week from tomorrow I'll be going back to Steak and Shake, which is one of my favorite restaurants as a kid, for the first time in 30 years, as I've just started introducing meat back in my diet, and I get to spend Bitcoin, which is my passion.
Isn't that, that's crazy, because it's like you changed your diet, then you were, now you're a toxic vaccine, now you're working for Jan3, now you're going to use your Aqua Wallet to buy the meat, at Steak and Shake that you grew up eating, it's like all this stuff is just like really crazy to think about how that stuff works out in your life. That's so funny.
Yeah.
That's a really cool story.
Yeah. The Steak and Shake thing was sort of my initiative around, well, let's make this. I mean, everybody's talking about it on Twitter. It's not my thing, but like this idea, well, why don't we do it around Aqua and, do it at the Vegas conference? And
yeah, that's amazing. So where are you living right now?
I live in Monterrey, Mexico, which is about 3 hours south of the Texas border.
Okay. And then, so when you're working with, because what I saw about you working with Jan3 now is you're working on building these like Bitcoin cities or circular economies, or what are you doing for that?
Interesting question. So my pitch to Jan3 was Jan3 leadership. Obviously, Samson and his partner are fabulous at doing nation state engagement. If you recall from our earlier discussion, I've been in the smart city space for a long time and have made concerted efforts to think about how could a local state or city embrace Bitcoin way beyond just as a reserve, but like how could you, as we move up the spectrum in my book, I talk about the phase we're now is Bitcoinization, then hyper Bitcoinization comes, and then ultimately Bitcoin singularity, which I define as the point in time in the future when basically Bitcoin is both ubiquitous as a money, as a base layer of the economy, but also the cypherpunk ethos is also ingrained in our economy in terms of the values around it. And so I've been thinking a lot around how important it is for cities to embrace Bitcoin, provide incentives around it, accept payment in Bitcoin, support innovators, Bitcoin developers who are building things around it, try to address the taxation around gains and stuff so people can buy and spend and use it, how they support local businesses to accept Bitcoin and promote circular economies in their community. So I've been thinking about all these things. I have a chapter on that topic in the book. And so I was like, okay, Jan3 has this top-down strategy by looking at nation states. They have a totally grassroots thing with Aqua, which just, has a life of its own through community adoption and their, social media outreach to get more users. But there's a middle layer that was missing in their strategy. This was my view anyway, which is why not think about cities as an interesting focus of adoption for Aqua and Bitcoin in general, because cities are where people live for the most part. 70% of the world lives in cities or near them. And most people identify more with the city or state region they live in than the country they live in. They have more network connections there. They engage with the local businesses there, all those things. So we should get to people where they are, and people are in cities, not in countries. And in my book, I also talk about how I believe the future of Bitcoin singularity is accelerated demise of the nation state. Either we won't have them anymore, or their importance will be so minimal because they won't have the money printer anymore. And I think we'll start to see national borders fall. And while this is a controversial statement, not just in Bitcoin, in the world, I think the world would be a better place if we had freedom of movement across borders. And I've had direct experiences with the lack of that, including a good example, when I met my wife, she was living in Venezuela. I was living in Canada. And she got her first visa to come visit, and they rejected her for the second one because they thought she might not go back to Venezuela. This was before we were married. And it's like, why should some national government be able to stop a law-abiding, tax-paying citizen from having his partner visit him, whether that's for a day, a month, or a year? Why does a government have a right to refuse that, right? So I find it kind of amusing that Bitcoiners are often like pro-government borders and like making it really hard for people to migrate. And I understand the anti-immigration for criminal activity and all that stuff. But, you know, when you think about the values of Bitcoin, it should be about sovereignty and permissionlessness and freedom of goods and people to move wherever they want.
Yeah. I think that part of that, the borders of the nations, has a lot to do with the fiat world, because you figure every time they have to cross borders and change their currency from one to the other, it's like the fiat world does create these borders. So it's like you have people coming from other countries, bringing their money from here and there. Do we want them here? You know, so it's like a lot of that is a problem. So when you start to disintegrate this, when the world turns towards, you know, Bitcoin as a global currency.
I've lived in Europe 3 times, and the first time I lived there, they all had their own currencies and they didn't have the European Union formed around the euro. The second time I lived there, they were transitioning. In fact, I remember I was living in Madrid at the time, and I went in the Puerta del Sol, which is the main plaza in the middle of Madrid, for New Year celebration, which they always do a big celebration there. It was on January 1st at 12:01, they started issuing euros from the ATMs, and there was an ATM in many ATMs around this plaza, and a bunch of us went in line because we just wanted to be amongst the first people in the world to hold euros. But like, once that happened, it became even easier to just freely roam anywhere in Europe. You didn't have to carry a bunch of coins with you. So that's like a precursor in a way, even though Europe has fumbled so many things, but it is a precursor in a way to imagine what happens when you actually have multiple countries, say, forget having our own currency that we can each manipulate and print. Obviously, they didn't get all the way where they need to get to sound money. They still have fiat. It's just, you know, managed from a central bank in Belgium instead of from each of the nation states. I think the future is going to be, and I do mention this in the book towards the end, like when we get towards Bitcoin singularity, that the role of the nation state will either be in demise or not even existent anymore for the most part, and that we'll have more freedom of movement, and that economies will be organized more around like nodes of like cities, going back to why I think it's important for Aqua to start thinking about cities, like where people live and congregate and engage in commerce is where they live and work. And then when they travel somewhere else, and, you know, going at that middle layer, I think is an important thing, which is what I had mentioned to Jan 3. But where I think the world could go, or at least I'd like it to go there, is that if a nation state or some sort of territory wants to tax you, even though they don't control the money anymore, because we would be in Bitcoin standard, they have to provide services you value. And what I envision a future looking like is like a software as a service model. You're like, okay, I don't know if you're familiar with Balaji. He's
yes.
Famous thinker, author. He wrote The Network State. He's
talking dollar about Bitcoin prediction.
Yeah, that too. But he explores in his book the future of like a world without nation states, or at least the potential existence of some form of citizenship associated with a digital network that's not tied to a specific territory or not bound by one, and that it's digitally connected no matter where you live to a certain set of values and everything else. And kind of what I envision in the future is like, you can decide what services you want from the local territory you live in. Like, there are certain things maybe you're minimum required to have to pay into, like, because you need access to, you're not going to have your own fire department and probably your own police department as like a sovereign individual or this digitally connected network state. That might not work. So there might be some base services. So like, You want to live in our community, forget all the passport crap and everything else. But like, yes, you need to pay, you know, in dollar terms, let's say it's $60 a month. And $60 a month, you get the minimum services that a citizen of our territory needs to have, police and fire and whatever the minimum is. Maybe healthcare is like a layer above that. You can pay extra. So instead of 60 a month, you're paying 120 and you get access to a certain amount of healthcare. Or you can say, you know what? I don't want to pay into your healthcare system. I'm paying into a separate one in my network state. And there's, you know, a network of Bitcoiners all around the world, including doctors who are part of this interconnected nodal network of healthcare services. And you can pay into that instead. So you pay the $60 base thing in to get your base services wherever you physically live. And then the other things you might want access to, maybe even things like citizen services, like around passports or whatever. No, I don't want the passport of the physical territory I live in. I want the network state Bitcoin network passport. I think that's where we're going to go, and that you basically have different scales of how much you pay into whatever services you want. And then they'll move away from being able to tax you on income, because you'll be able to freely move wherever you go. So they can only tax you in the form of services delivered. And if they try to be exorbitant with their service fees, you can move to the next neighborhood, the next town, the next whatever that's offering you a better deal.
That's so true. I could totally see that happening. Would you be starting to do this in like where you live in your city areas, or more in El Salvador?
So Gen 3, my role is focusing primarily on Latin America. So I've already started doing outreach on that. We got our first sort of win early on, which is a conference that's going to happen in Mexico. We agreed to be like their formal partner for the conference. And we're looking at ways to make it fun in Merida, Mexico, to like use the Aqua Wallet with local circular economy businesses. And so we're working on that. It's an early stage because that conference is in December. So we have a little bit of time. And I've started doing some more outreach. I reached out to the mayor of Panama City. You might have seen recently that they're going to try to start taking Bitcoin as a currency. I think I'm allowed to say this publicly. I think so. Gen3 is working on a Bitcoin ATM solution as well. And so I'm representing them in Latin America on the city scale to try to help with Aqua Wallet adoption as well as the ATM adoption.
That's awesome. I can't even, like, that's so cool to hear. I love all the stuff that they're building, and I'm so excited for Latin America. I can't wait to see all the progress.
For sure.
Yeah. I know you had somewhere to go after this, so I don't want to keep you too long too. But thank you so much for joining me today. It was really fun talking to you. And I can't wait to see what else you do. And I want to follow your page and see what you come up with.
Thank you, Stacey. It was great to virtually meet you.
Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Take care.